And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 p.m. Stay tuned next for your own health and fitness.
Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment.
Mark Twain famously wrote from California that in the West, people drink whiskey and fight about water. Historically, while the humans fought, the ecosystems suffered. With time, the situation has gotten worse. The history of the Colorado River is a horror story. By law, the flow of the Colorado River has been completely divvied up among various jurisdictions and human users. Almost 4 out of every 5 gallons of the Colorado River's waters are allocated to agriculture, principally industrial agriculture, that has turned arid lands into a cornucopia of crops and cash. Almost half of the Colorado's waters are transported out of its ecosystem to turn other arid lands into cornucopias of crops and cash. An absurd consequence is that more water is promised to users in a typical year than the Colorado can actually deliver. And so it is often the case that the ecosystem of the Gulf of California, fed over the last 40 million years by the free flow of the Colorado River, doesn't get a single drop. A group of activists working to change things in the Colorado River ecosystem have filed a lawsuit on behalf of the ecosystem against the state of Colorado. This isn't just another environmental lawsuit. It's one of a growing number of legal and political actions being taken to change how the natural world is treated by humans in their legal, political, and cultural systems. Today, we're going to talk about the rights of the Colorado River ecosystem. My guests are Deanna Meyer and Will Falk. Both are members of Deep Green Resistance and two of the people intimately involved with this radical lawsuit. Deanna Meyer is a longtime environmental activist and a co-founder and executive director of Prairie Protection Colorado. Meyer's work currently centers on the rights of nature movement, with hopes that it will inspire others to take up similar strategies that will effectively protect life and land. Will Falk is a writer, lawyer, and activist. He believes the intensifying destruction of the natural world is the most pressing issue confronting us today. A Society of Professional Journalists San Diego Chapter 2016 Journalism Award winner, Will's work has been published by Earth Island Journal, the Dark Mountain Project, Counterpunch, and the San Diego Free Press, among others. Deanna and Will, welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I am going to kind of bounce back and forth between the two of you in terms of answering questions because you have different perspectives on this issue. And where I really wanted to start with is what the significance of this lawsuit is. And Deanna, if you could start by talking about what its significance is from the standpoint of environmental activism.
Sure. Well, all of us who have been working in the environmental activist community have noticed the history that this has been going on, and we've been building a movement since the 60s. There are more organizations now and more structures of environmental groups that are doing various different things to protect the planet. Yet we see that the planet is in worse shape now than ever, and that the whole planet really is in a complete biotic collapse. Every system that we see or every natural community that we are aware of is in decline. So what something like this would do is be able to have a different strategy that might actually be able to protect the ecosystems and the natural communities that we have all fought so hard to do by actually recognizing that these communities have a right to exist and flourish, naturally evolve, regenerate, and be naturally evolved. So it's just really a different strategy to actually have tools that will enable people who are willing to fight for the natural world and for the last remnants of these wild lands and wildlife that is remaining and these ecosystems and water systems, and to actually have a chance to protect them.
Well, from a standpoint of the legal system, what's the significance of this lawsuit?
Well, it's the first lawsuit of its kind in federal court, a lawsuit that seeks personhood for the Colorado River. And the reason that this is so important in American law is the American legal system currently defines nature as property. And nature is an object, a thing that can be consumed and destroyed. And this legal theory, this jurisprudence, is directly contributing to the collapse of every major ecosystem on the continent. So this lawsuit is aimed, from a legal perspective, at undermining that practice of defining nature as property. And we've seen over the course of American history that the best way to protect things or people that used to be defined as property is by granting them personhood and standing to sue in the court of law. In American history, African Americans were once viewed as property, as slaves, and it took giving African Americans personhood until we're able to say that they are indeed equal citizens in the United States. So this lawsuit, in a similar way, seeks to redefine nature as a being with inherent value that is something we all depend upon for life, and turning nature from property into a being with inherent value.
If you win this case, I want to ask Will first, what will we be able to do legally that we couldn't do before?
Yeah, the short answer and the legal answer is that the Colorado River will have the power to seek injunction from the court. And an injunction is a court order that compels someone to do something. So the river could ask from the courts for an injunction against pollution from a corporation, for example, and the court could order that corporation to stop what it's doing. If we win, we're also asking for the Colorado River to be able to request money damages. So we could help the river ask the court for money to repair itself after a big oil spill or a big mining spill, for example. But the more common sense, concrete thing that I think all activists can understand about this is we will get the courts on our side. We all know what happens when, as activists, we try to block activities that are destructive to the environment. We all know that if we went into the Nestle plastic bottling operations on the river and tried to disrupt their activities, that the court would order police to come and remove us from their property. Well, if we win this case, we'll be able to use the courts in a similar way against corporations. We can ask the courts to put the police on our side to stop destructive activities.
And speaking of corporations and other entities that have personhood, you mentioned in one of your articles that the New York Times, when it reported on this lawsuit, said, well, if corporations can be persons, why can't ecosystems? Which is intended to frame this in some way for listeners to this interview. But in the course of discussing that issue in your petition before the court, it turns out that things like ships that ships are have a certain standing as persons as well. Is that right? So this is essentially the point here is that this is not an unusual legal situation for non-humans or entities that are not human beings, correct?
Yeah, that's true. Beginning in the middle of the 1880s, as is maybe famously known on the left, corporations were granted personhood and standing. Corporations, of course, are not real in the same sense that a river is real. A corporation is an organization of individuals. It's organized to limit the liability to these individuals, and quite frankly, to protect them from the outrage of the public when they're exploiting the natural world. So corporations have had these same rights that we're asking for the river since the 1880s. Another really interesting thing about corporate personhood is actually many women in the United States did not achieve the same rights as corporations had until the 1920s. So this tradition of granting rights to abstractions, to things that are not actually real, is a time-honored tradition in American law, and it's something that we're hoping to change, especially for the ecosystems that we all depend on. I think we can all agree that the Colorado River does more for life than any corporation does, and therefore should have rights.
And along this line of what happens when you win the case, Deanna, what organizing opportunities do you see arising with the success of this case?
I see a lot of different opportunities that would, but mainly it would be a way for communities to actually protect themselves from the corporate theft of their community, of the things in the life that we value so much. So even, for example, in Colorado, people are always very, right now we have a development that's just absolutely rampant, and we have fracking going on that's using an enormous amount of water from the Colorado River that actually ends up poisoning and harming communities. But right now we don't have the tools without these community rights that CELDEF has been working hard on, that this lawsuit is aimed towards in terms of rights of nature. And to have something like this succeed, and even having it out in the public mind of a way to deal with these issues, it would give communities rights and the tools they need to protect the natural communities that we depend on for our health and our well-being. And it also helps protect those natural communities for their inherent worth as well. So something like this and having it go through our courts would really change the opportunities that we have for actually putting protections in place that would do something to protect. Because now in all the fights that we've done in various cases with CELDEF, you go up before your local governments, the way that everything is looked at as property, and they always look at you, like with fracking, say, "I'm sorry, our hands are tied." Well, this would help that go away. The hands wouldn't be tied anymore. We'd actually have a tool to work with that would actually be able to help us protect who we are, to protect our future, and to protect the natural communities that really are part of us and enable us to live in a quality of life where we're not getting sick and we are able to experience what we're meant to.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Deanna Meyer and Will Falk from Deep Green Resistance about the first of its kind lawsuit to establish rights for the Colorado River ecosystem. So, Deanna, you mentioned CELDEF, which is an organization that you are working with, but it's also an organization that we've featured on this show several times. And it's the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and it is an advisor and there to you, and it is an important organization that, just in terms of its approach and strategy, is very much the kind of thing that you are discussing right now. I suppose another important thing to emphasize here that is related to rights of nature that CELDEF emphasizes is community rights, which is in a similar position legally as natural systems. So am I correct in that, Will, that right now a community outside of just whatever a government agency, a body, a corporate body, whatever rights it has, but a community of people has no rights. It again is reduced to whatever property law can be brought to bear on an issue. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's something that CELDEF often calls the box of allowable activism.
Yes.
And that box contains what communities can actually do through several ways. One of those ways is the United States Constitution, through the Commerce Clause, actually prevents the interference of interstate commerce and establishes the Constitution and constitutional law as something that is prioritized over the needs of communities across the nation. So if what CELDEF in particular was finding through years of environmental law of trying to help communities protect themselves, they were finding that every time they tried to keep a corporate hog farm out of a community or keep fracking wells from being drilled in a community, they were running up against constitutional arguments that said actually under the United States Constitution, interstate commerce trumps a community's right to keep these projects out of their boundaries. There's other laws such as preemption, which says that a community ordinance, a municipality's laws, cannot be more strict than the laws of a state. So if you wanted to enact some regulations in your community, they can't be any more strict than the state has passed. And a state, in a lot of states, they actually pass laws that say you have to allow fracking or those corporate hog farms into your communities. So activists in local communities are finding that when they try to pass these ordinances, they hear from their city attorney that, you know, this is actually illegal. You can't do this. And if we do this, the state is going to sue us and it's going to cost the municipality and therefore the taxpaying citizens of that community a lot of money to litigate this case.
What I wanted to point listeners' attention to is that there is an issue of community rights, which is parallel here to ecosystem rights. And what you've described is how that manifests itself in the court system. Which leads me to get kind of to the heart of the petition that you've submitted to the Colorado, it's the appeals court, yes, Federal Appeals Court of Colorado. Is that correct?
No, we're still at the district level. The first court.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in your petition, you ask that the court recognize five distinct rights that the Colorado River ecosystem has, and those are the right to exist, the right to flourish, the right to regenerate, the right to be restored, and the right to naturally evolve. So, Will, if you could, I'm not sure how much time it would take to do this, but it would be good to have an example of what exercising those rights by the Colorado River would mean concretely.
Yeah, I think that starts with understanding what a right actually is or how rights actually work, and I can sum that up pretty quickly. A right is something that gives a person or a legal entity like a corporation at this time the ability to request access to the power of the state, the ability to request the court to compel someone to do something. So if the river had these five rights that you just read off, the river could go into a court and ask the court to compel someone to stop an action that is interfering with their rights, or to take an action to facilitate the river's rights. In terms of each of those individual rights that you've listed, I think some obvious examples in terms of let's say the river's right to regenerate. Well, right now, the Colorado River is horribly overdrawn, but ecologically, the way it regenerates is through snowpack. So it depends upon the clouds that bring snow to the region every year to bring back the waters that have been taken. Well, climate change is seriously threatening snowpack and causing less and less snow to fall across the Rocky Mountain West. So if the river had the right to regenerate, you could go into court and say that the river's right to regenerate has been offended by, say, the fracking in the Uinta Basin of Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. That fracking is drawing out fossil fuels that are being burned that are causing climate change, which are preventing the river from regenerating. So that's how these rights would be enforced if they were granted rights.
And Deanna, from the standpoint of organizing around this, that Will's kind of talked about the enforcement aspect, and I kind of vulgarly refer to bringing in people with rights are enforced by people with guns and badges. Ultimately, that may be a little too Maoist for some people, but really, actually, what it really boils down to is organizing people in various ways to take actions that enforce those rights, and being able to enlist government entities, entities of the state, to do that. So how do you envision that dynamic working, that once those rights are established, it is probably going to be not an easy thing when the rights of the Colorado River are competing with the rights of fracking companies?
Go
ahead. Either one of you.
I've been talking a lot, Deanna. You go.
Okay. Well, I would just envision that, kind of like Will was saying there, if the courts granted that the river would have a right to exist, it would be kind of, right now, the corporations have a right to destroy the river or to take more than actually exists. So we have Nestle, you know, bottling company out there, and they're taking 500 million gallons of water approximately from the Colorado River and putting it in plastic bottles and selling it to people. And currently now, as it stands, with the river having no rights and being recognized as property only, we really don't have any recourse. If I wanted to go to court and say, look, this is excessive use, this shouldn't be happening, and talk about the plastic bottles and all the waste there or whatever, I don't have any standing at all, nor does the river, but the corporation does. And then if I go to the next step and I think, well, what else could I do to stop this atrocity from happening? And I march over to the Nestle Water Company and I stage a nonviolent, you know, direct action approach. The police would come in with their badges and their guns, and they would escort me and whoever else was willing to do that right out of there. And that is because they have those rights to do that under the legal system. So if that was the playing ground was leveled out, and we would say that the river has that right to exist, and that this excessive use of taking the water for profit was infringing on that right, then we would have the people who are affected and care, and who the river would be able to be protected in a much more efficient way, using those same tools that currently the corporations can use to protect their ability to profit and to get away with destroying.
Well, let me ask a related question, which has to do with the case, and it is what came into my mind was cases like Brown v. Board of Education that basically overturned a much older precedent, court precedent of separate but equal, that African Americans, they have to be given access to equal education. So that, and that case turned on social conditions outside the court. So it's the courts, when they make decisions, don't make them in the abstract, in a Platonic plane. They actually examine social conditions. And in the petition itself, I note that you make a case of why this action is important from the standpoint of the survival of the Colorado River ecosystem, I don't have a really good way to ask this question, but what do you view as the prevailing social conditions that support this petition that you're putting forward? And that's, Deanna, you can talk to that, or Will, if you want to go first, but originally I thought of asking Deanna that question. What are the social conditions that, I guess you would argue in front of the court, make this pertinent at this point of why are we going to overturn all of this but add this whole new set of rights that, it actually presses against the way in which the legal system operates now.
Yeah, for sure. I think all of us, unless we're really asleep, and I'm not saying that some of us are not asleep, but we can recognize the situation that we're in as a biotic being on this planet and as watching climate change and the incredible backlash right now of climate against the actions that we have taken by seeing all of the natural world as a piece of property that is there to be used and abused for profit. And just right now is a great time. I mean, we pick up the phone with you and there's fires everywhere over on the West Coast. And we've seen a hurricane season that's been quite alarming this time. I mean, the storms are getting more and more severe everywhere. And as we're seeing here in Colorado and in many other places, there's just such an enormous level of rampant development, which is very scary because the tapestry of life has been reduced to such an extent. So anybody who's awake and noticing, we're losing the habitable planet at a very rapid rate. And more people are starting to understand that the way we view property and land and everything and the power that corporate interests do have is becoming a very dangerous prospect for us. And if we want to be here for longer or as long as we can maintain, I mean, if we want to continue to live on this living and breathing planet, then we need to decide and to really change things. And I do believe that more and more people are recognizing this as essential and important. And as you've said, I mean, we're seeing this starting to happen in other countries and nations and other mm-hmm. places.
Yes.
So I think people are looking for something. They're wondering because communities are frustrated that they really don't have an ability to say no. They don't have an ability to stop violations on their own wealth, on themselves, on their families, on the communities they care for.
And Will, just from the machinations of how the courts incorporate existing social conditions. I mean, the other area that came to my mind was all of the issues around what does and does not count as pornography, or what, you know, current social norms of how these kinds of arguments, the kinds of arguments that Deanna has just made, how you expect those to play out in the court's deliberations over this petition.
Yeah, this is going to be presented to the court as an opportunity to bring the American legal system into the 21st century, to bring the legal system into a contemplation of a lot of the things that Deanna just said, into a situation where we're losing close to 200 species a day to extinction, into a situation where some scientists are saying we won't have any fish left in the seas by 2050. So just like Brown versus Board of Education was an opportunity for the American legal system to resolve a contradiction that has haunted the American system since the beginning, and that is in a system devoted to the proposition that all humans are equal, how do you still have segregation? So when Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and he said that the most important of his certain inalienable rights was the right to life, how do you not give life the ability to protect itself? So, the social conditions are going to be there in the court, and they're going to be something that we draw upon. It's courts, guess courts have to or do rely on precedent, but courts have also overturned bad and unjust precedent in the past. And we can point to things like Brown versus Board of Education to say that the American justice system is flexible enough, is nimble enough to make changes when it has become so absolutely clear that changes must be made. So that's the argument that we'll make. And it's a completely valid argument. It has complete legal merit, and it's something that the court can, if a friendly judge rules in our favor, she will have enough information to go on. She will have the prevailing social conditions to consider while making that decision.
Good. Well, thank you. I'm going to have to take a brief musical break right now. When we come back, I'll continue talking with Deanna Meyer and Will Falk about the rights of natural communities and the Colorado River ecosystem in particular. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Deanna Meyer and Will Falk from Deep Green Resistance about the first of its kind lawsuit to establish rights for the Colorado River ecosystem. Our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, has more information about this show and our archive of over 700 shows, a free stream of today's show, and access to our archive of show recordings using our library card feature. To contact us, email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Deanna and Will, how can listeners learn more about your work and this case in particular?
Okay, yeah, sure. You can go to our website, deepgreenresistance.org, and the the court filing is up on that website. Is that correct, Will?
Yeah, it's on dgrnewsservice.org.
All right.
We will have links to those on our website in relation to this show, this interview. In the petition you've submitted, you and others in Deep Green Resistance are listed as next friends, bringing to action on behalf of the Colorado River ecosystem. So, Will, from a legal, well, a practical standpoint as well, talk about what next friends is a technical legal term. Talk some about that term, what it means, and especially in the context of the broader issue of rights of nature, and why that concept is important.
Yeah, to serve as a next friend is to serve as a fiduciary or a guardian of the river's interests in court. Under current American law, the Colorado River is not considered legally competent, so it must have next friends represent its interests in court. This is similar to cases involving a minor child or the mentally disabled, people who have rights but need a next friend to represent their interests in court. And we in DGR have a long history of representing the river's interests, and so we feel like we are our great next friends to the Colorado River.
And that is something, actually, I'd like Deanna to talk to this issue, that one of the things that is in the petition is that you justify your qualifications as next friends by discussing how that qualifies. And actually in the petition, I believe there's a discussion of judicial efficiency so that the court isn't burdened with frivolous lawsuits. So how does one demonstrate that you are qualified to be a next friend of the Colorado River ecosystem or an ecosystem?
So with DGR, we're all a part of the people on the lawsuit are all a part of the DGR Southwest Coalition. And several years ago, in fact, in 2013, people were getting involved with water issues of the Colorado Basin and had actually formed alliances, the Ely Shoshone, and were working in opposition to the Southern Nevada Water Authority's groundwater development project, which is a project that is still planning. They haven't done it yet, but they would like to be able to divert about 27 billion gallons of water from the Colorado Basin over to Las Vegas. And anyway, in 2015, we all did sit down, and we talked a lot about the issue of water in the West, and we have all decided and came to the conclusion, wrote up a statement of which water is principal and is our main goal, the protection of water for our coalition, namely because we're in the West, and we recognize that water is extraordinarily important for every community, natural communities, human communities. We all depend on water ever more so in the West. The West is built on this water empire that really doesn't exist. So we need to figure out, and have always understood that we need to work on these projects. So we worked on the Southern Nevada Water Authority's groundwater development and in educating the public of what this is, what's going on, why we need to stop it. Yearly, we do a sacred water tour in that area, talking about the importance of the water in the West and its function to the Colorado River. And we also have a Pinyon Juniper Alliance. So we've been working really hard to preserve pinyon juniper forests in the West that are being eradicated right now. And in those eradication, it destroys the water of the Colorado River Basin by its silt runoff and all kinds of things that happens when you take out a key stone species from an environment in a situation to put in an invasive species, cattle. So that's what's kind of going on there. And we've also formed a water protection and climate change action campaign around the Colorado River and the river water in regards to oil and gas fracking processes, where we've been working, you know, at this point in educating and trying to initiate public response and grassroots activism to protect the Colorado River and all of the tributaries that are going into that. So water for DGR and for the Southwest Coalition is primary, and also for our organization in general, we recognize that the rights of the natural world are primary, and that the air, the water, the climate, and the food we eat are created by complex communities of living creatures. And so that's always been an essential point, and we've always been working very hard to protect the Colorado River Basin.
Well, it's, speaking of that issue of say, talking about primary, in the petition itself is very carefully written. The argument is very clear. And it, actually, I encourage listeners to go and read it. It is, a compelling document, and it is not, it's only about 10, it's in the neighborhood of 10 pages long. I may be off on that, a couple of pages, but, it presents the argument very clearly. Deanna just used one of the key concepts from that, and there's another one that I wanted to ask you both about. You've already started to address it some, and it is addressed in the petition itself. But the two concepts or the two phrases that get used are primary, as in, and this is a quote from the petition, the needs of natural communities are primary. The second phrase concept is humble relationship, as in, and again, this is a quote from the petition, individual morality, institutional morality, and law must emerge from a humble relationship with these natural communities. So, from a legal stand, well, I guess the first thing that popped into my head when I read those is, just because I'm attuned to such things, that this is being used as a technical term, as if it had a specific meaning other than the rhetorical one that those two phrases obviously are being used for. So what I first wanted to ask Will is, do those concepts have legal meaning? That is, in terms of legal jargon, do they have a place in the law? Or is it the case that by incorporating them into this case, it is your objective to give them legal meaning in the law?
Those phrases, I think the most accurate way to say that is those phrases reflect ecological reality first. It should be obvious by now that all life depends on clean water, breathable air, healthy soil, and the complex relationships that all living beings form in natural communities. So when we say that the needs of these natural communities are primary, we're trying to, through this case, have the American legal system reflect ecological reality. Then the second phrase that deals with the humble relationship, what that reflects is the reality that for hundreds of thousands of years, humans lived in a humble relationship with their natural communities. And they didn't do this by chance. They didn't do this just out of coincidence. They did this through crafting their cultures in a way that humble relationships were foundational to the way that they lived. And if we think that if humanity has any chance of surviving the current collapse that we see all around us, cultures are going to have to return to this humble relationship. And law is integral to the way that cultures are formed. And the American legal system represents a tool, a mechanism that that could teach this humble relationship. So if the court ruled in our favor and decided that, yes, indeed, the needs of natural communities are primary and that they want law to emerge from a humble relationship with natural communities, those phrases could be precedent, and those phrases could be used by other groups and other communities that are seeking rights for ecosystems. And these phrases could form something like foundational texts or foundational concepts that the rights of nature in the United States could use as a foothold to become stronger and help our culture reflect ecological reality.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. I'm talking today with Deanna Meyer and Will Falk about who are from Deep Green Resistance about their lawsuit to bring rights to natural communities in the Colorado River in particular. Deanna, now, these concepts that we have been discussing, or that Will just got through discussing from a legal perspective, from an organizing perspective, how do these provide you, what kind of tools do these provide you with?
Yeah, from organizing, it's just extremely important to recognize that what we've been doing hasn't been working. Like I said before, the environmental movement has been around for several decades, where it's gained support, and many, many people are more and more interested. But I think that because we don't view the world as primary, and, you know, because we're not seeing that natural communities have, you know, an inherent right to exist, that we've been seeing an incredible decline, so, in natural communities. So you look at, and a lot of this has just happened in the last several decades. So we have 99% of the prairies are gone. 98% of old forests are gone. Over 90% of all the fish, large fish in the ocean are gone. And this pattern is very recurrent, and it's happening everywhere. Every single river is poisoned. We're losing groundwater like at an incredible and alarming rate. So what is it that's happening to where we're getting more and more people interested in environmental movement and activism, but we're getting less and less benefits or improvements? We're not seeing anything improve. We're seeing things get worse. And I think that organizing from this idea that, you know, the natural world is primary, that, you know, that we are a part of nature, not apart from nature. We are need nature to continue to exist, is an absolute necessity in the way that we do things. In the environmental movement, you also see a lot of what happens is negotiating. And we negotiate thousands of acres away so that we can save a couple hundred acres. And people do that for money, and they do it because they think, well, it's better than none. And I think we're at the point now where it's just incredibly, we can't lose anymore. And in fact, we have to learn how to start restoring and looking at life much different. It's not something there for the taking. It's not something that we're above and over, and it's not for our own enjoyment, because a lot of our movement too is about, well, we want wilderness for our happiness, for our sense of peace, for our state of mind. And I think it kind of needs to go back to what traditional communities, definitely needs to go back to what traditional communities had viewed it, and why we're still here on this planet was because for the majority of the time humans have been here, we have had a humble relationship, and we have with the land, and we have recognized the absolute necessity for those natural communities to be healthy and to be in place and to not be completely destroyed.
Although this is the first case of its kind in the United States, it's not the first case of its kind in the world. And you cite some of those cases in those instances in your petition about other nation states where rights of nature have been implemented in one way or another. So, Deanna, could you talk about how what you're doing is similar and how it might be different from how those rulings in other nation states came about?
I think that what we're doing and what those other nation states and a couple, especially like Ecuador and Bolivia, that we've been following the model of CELDEF, and Ecuador got their model there too, and they have implemented rights of nature in the Constitution. And so I think that we're similar in the path of understanding the foundations of rights of nature and of looking at these other nations that have been able to do it, Australia and India and New Zealand. Australia was just real recent. And being able to, and looking at that model and following that model and using the guidance of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund to really start educating and becoming aware of the power and the importance of this type of law to actually be able to protect life, because like I said before, we're not really doing that so well. What's different is that we're far behind here in the United States. Our nation is built on corporate rights. And it's built on the whole idea that nature is there for the taking. And it's very fundamental. Property. We own property. If we own property, we own all the natural communities on those properties, and therefore we can kill them. We can destroy them and obliterate them for our own, you know, for our own gain. And I think these other places that have actually been able to push these rights of nature forward to the point of it's written in their constitution are so far ahead in the way of viewing natural communities as a part of them and necessary for human health and for quality of life, and you know that they have in their systems and their nation or their legal systems, everything else, are not as heavily reliant and based on the idea of exploitation and corporate wealth. And I think we're going to have a big. We have a big, we have to chip this big rock, you know, we've got to start chipping away at this in this country and really trying to bring it to the forefront like these other places have been able to do.
Will, I know that, it may come as a surprise to some listeners to hear this, but, the courts in the United States actually do pay attention to, what courts internationally do. Not that they necessarily follow it, but they do pay attention. I wonder what weight these precedents from other countries will have on the court that will be hearing your case.
They will have weight. There's several reasons I think that the courts will be paying attention, that the courts will give these decisions in other jurisdictions some weight. The first is jurisdictions like New Zealand and India and Australia, these are old English common law systems, much like the American legal system is based in. So these are places where English colonial legal systems developed in these countries, and then when independence was taken or granted, a lot of those English traditions stayed there. So Their legal systems look pretty similar to the American legal system. So I think that is one thing that we have going in our favor. But then I think maybe more intuitively and maybe more in a common sense way, these decisions around the world reflect a growing rights of nature movement. They reflect a growing popular demand for changes in our legal structure to deal with ecological collapse. So I think that courts, you know, I think that there will be friendly judges, and there are definitely American judges that want to do the right thing, and they're looking for the justifications to do the right thing. And when they can look at all these other countries and see that these other judges in these other countries have decided to take a bold stand and recognize the rights of nature, I think that American judges will want to do the same thing. So, you know, we're certainly hopeful that that's going to happen, and we're certainly hopeful that the judge in our case thinks that way.
Now, on that note, one thing that has been kind of on my mind is the fact that the most recent appointment to the Supreme Court is from the same appellate district where your case is being heard, and he's kind of a horror story. Is the court where you're going to, where this is going to be heard and where it's going to move up, one way or almost certainly one way or another through the court system, are you in a good position or a bad position? And more generally, what do you think the prospects for the case are now?
Well, we've provided to the judge in our complaint enough legal precedent, enough legal justification for her to rule in our favor. In terms of whether the District of Denver, the United States District of Court in Denver, is a friendly place for this kind of thing, I think it is. Just last week, there was a decision in reference to Wolf Creek in Colorado. If I understand it correctly, the Forest Service wanted to sell this land so that a ski resort could be built on it, and a judge in the same district that we're in. Reprimanded the Forest Service for this and said that the Forest Service had engaged in a patent effort to circumvent its obligation to protect the natural environment of the forest. So what we're asking our judge to recognize is that the state of Colorado has circumvented its obligation to protect the natural environment of the Colorado River. So I think that this district is a good district for this case.
Yeah, Deanna, do you have anything to add?
I would just say similar, that, you know, we're seeing it, lots of times these are dependent on judges.
Yes.
And it's kind of the roll of the dice. Are you going to get a sympathetic judge or not? And we're hoping we will. And I think that we have a much better chance in Colorado than many other states in this situation.
Well, good luck to you. I'm sure our listeners are wishing you good luck. How can they find out more about what's going on and follow the case?
You can follow along at the website dgrnewsservice.org. We will be posting updates as they come out. You can find a complaint there as well, the actual petition that we've filed, so you can read and follow our legal arguments. And we're openly encouraging people to lift a lot of that text to use it in their own rights of nature's cases.
Deanna and Will, thank you so much for your time and very much for doing this work. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature, a free stream of this week's show, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please do so by email, admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett and Lena Berman. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.
Howdy, boys and girls. This is Chris Welch inviting you to join me every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 11 a.m. to noon for the Talkies. We'll discuss almost everything. The news, of course, and also theater, music, books, generally what's happening in our own backyard and what we can do about it. Your questions and comments are a vital part of the proceedings. That's the Talkies, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, 11 a.m. to noon on KPFA.
East Bay Meditation Center invites you to celebrate 10 years of radical inclusivity and liberation dharma on Monday, October 23rd at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley. This special fundraiser includes speakers, New York Times bestselling author Sharon Salzberg, East Bay Meditation Center's co-founder Larry Yang, and CEO of Impact Hub Oakland, Conda Mason. Our event is wheelchair accessible and ASL interpretation will be provided. To sign up to be a volunteer, donate, or learn more, please visit eastbaymeditation.org. This is a benefit for East Bay Meditation Center of Oakland.
I'm standing face down in the crowd. I look up and I see you. Can you see me now?
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley.